Well, it's wonderful to start again. My name is Paul Holdengrabe. I'm the Director of Public Programs here at the New York Public Library, now known live from the New York Public Library. As you know, my goal at this institution is to make this institution levitate. I've always wondered how much it weighs. I want to make it dance. I welcome you all to this season, the fall season 2009. Before welcoming to the stage the president of the New York Public Library, Paul Leclerc, just a few words. The upcoming season, you will have all received this little brochure. It will give you a sense of what we're doing. Do also log on to our website to find out what's happening. This week, for instance, we have Peter Coyote speaking with Rebecca Solnit. We also have an evening with Ryan Adams and Mary Louise Parker. Then we have a big event with Creative Time. We have some 40 artists coming in one day, so it's really speed dating with artists. I will be interviewing Peter Gelb from the opera, also Javier Marias, and many, many other goodies, so check it out. I also encourage you all to join the library, become a friend of the library. For just $40 a year, you become a friend of the library, and instead of paying $25 per ticket, you pay $15 per ticket. I will not be introducing Oliver Sacks tonight. That pleasure will come to Robert Silvers, one of our most treasured trustees, and also the editor of the New York Review of Books, one of the most high-minded, extraordinary publications, not only in America, but in the world. I wish I could introduce Oliver Sacks. I'm tempted to introduce Oliver Sacks. I will not introduce Oliver Sacks, but I would like to just mention one piece by Oliver Sacks that maybe many of you do not know. It is a marvelous piece by Oliver Sacks. It happens to have appeared not in the New York Review of Books. Some good things appear in other publications. And in this particular case, it appeared in The New Yorker in 1997. It's online, get it. It's called Water Babies. And it is a wonderful meditation, exploration of Oliver Sacks's pleasure. Wherever he goes in the world, he looks for a place where he can swim. He will tonight not talk about swimming, I don't think so, but he will be speaking about hallucinations, about what it means to wander mentally, about lucid hallucinations, maybe also about the taboo around hallucinations, what it means to hear voices. And it is a great pleasure to welcome him, but before welcoming him, let me welcome my own president of the New York Public Library, Paul Leclerc.
Thank you very much, Paul, and thank you for the dynamism, the energy, the brilliance, the passion that you bring to organizing live at the New York Public Library, the best lecture series that there is in New York City, we all know. I, too, would like to introduce Dr. Sacks tonight, but that pleasure quite deservedly falls to the wonderful Robert Silvers, in whose honor this lecture series is named. This is the 8th annual Robert B. Silvers lecture at the New York Public Library here in the Celeste Bartos Forum. And on behalf of all of the library's trustees and staff, and I'm delighted that our former chairman, Marshall Rose, who first brought me to the library, is with us tonight, as well as a number of other trustees, I'm really, really happy that you're here. This is a place of learning. It's a place where ideas are born, our readers using our materials are continuously reinterpreting the world through their own experiences and their creativity, and it's wonderful to have so many of you as friends of the library. If you're not already a friend, Paul has talked about this, but I've got to drive it home because this library depends very, very substantially on private sector support for its programs, its collections, and its services. Become a friend. Cost you the same price as a good haircut, I guess, $40, and that's tax deductible. So you can become a friend at a higher level, but one way or the other, do be a friend. And if you wish to do that, as soon as you get home, nypl.org will take you there. Our guest this evening is Dr. Oliver Sacks, the brilliant Oliver Sacks, physician, professor of neurology and psychiatry at Columbia University Medical Center, and also the university's first artist in residence. The New York Times has referred to him as, quote, the poet laureate of medicine. This series came into being 9 years ago through the generosity of Max Pilevsky, who unfortunately can't be with us here this evening. He's on the West Coast. But Max Pilevsky is a wonderful philanthropist, and like Bob Silvers himself, is a graduate of the University of Chicago. And he has a keen and deep appreciation, as I'm sure all of us do, for what Bob Silvers has done to enhance the intellectual life of America through his work at the New York Review of Books. And so Max somehow wanted to recognize Bob's contributions, in effect, to world culture. And his first idea was to pay for a statue to be created and cast and erected in Bryant Park. And that would have been charming, but it would have been static. And those of us who live in New York like dynamism. And so Bob very modestly said, no, but let's do something at the library. Let's do a lecture series. So we have this lecture series now, and it has attracted not only wonderful audiences such as yourself, but through Bob's choosing, some of the most brilliant minds at work today. Writers and thinkers such as Joan Didion, John Quetzi, Ian Buruma, Michael Kimmelman, Daniel Mendelsohn, and last year, Zadie Smith. Their individual and collective brilliance, I think, reflects the diversity of Bob's own interests, as well as his unflagging championship of the arts, letters, and the sciences. Robert Silvers, of course, is the co-founder, together with Barbara Epstein and Jason Epstein, and now he is the sole surviving member of that wonderful group of three, and the sole editor of the New York Review of Books, a publication that has been the standard bearer for literary and aesthetic criticism here in America and around the English-speaking world for more than 40 years. But I think we will all agree, those of us who are passionate readers and subscribers to the New York Review, and if you're not a subscriber, like if you're not a friend, you should be a subscriber, the years have not mellowed the Review, as we all know. It is still the best incubator for fierce opinions and peerless insights, and it remains a source of revelation to thinking people the world over. Robert Silvers' commitment to the intersection of literature and scholarship is also evident in his work beyond the Review. He is a book editor, anthologizer, translator, editorial advisor to La Rivista dei Libri, the first foreign language edition of the Review. He is a member of the Council on Foreign Relations, and I'm very, very proud to say, has served ably and wisely and in a most devoted kind of way as a trustee of the New York Public Library since 1987. He's been honored for his good works both in this country and abroad. In addition to being a fellow of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, he's been named a Chevalier de l'Ordre National du Mérite and a member of the French Legion of Honor. I'm delighted that this evening brings together both Robert Silvers and Oliver Sacks at the library. And before asking Bob to come up, I'm told that I must give praise and acknowledgement to the Live's corporate sponsor, Sutherland, for their generosity in helping us make this entire series possible. And now, ladies and gentlemen, please welcome the great, the incomparable, the one of a kind, Robert Silvers.
Thank you, Paul, very much. And before these lectures happened, I felt that editors like myself should, on the whole, work with writers, should stay out of sight, somewhere in the middle distance, you might say. But then Max Pilevsky made this truly startling suggestion to do something in my name, and I was not only touched by his generosity, I also felt an editor's impulse to do something to honor writers I greatly admired, and do so in a way that would involve the two institutions that have meant the most to me, the New York Review, now in its 46th year, and the New York Public Library, which seems to me one of the most admirable institutions we have, is a truly democratic source of the mind of the city. And so I have to say thanks to the library and thanks to Max. Now, after our lecturers, running from Joan Didion to Zadie Smith, I must say that when Oliver Sacks said he would give this lecture, it was the realization of a fantasy of mine, or perhaps I should even say a hallucination. For an editor like myself, he's been a true hero of contemporary thought. He's our most intrepid explorer of the mysteries of the mind. Now, looking back, I remember his first book on migraines. It was 1970. It was reviewed for us by none other than W.H. Auden, who underlined what he found to be the cardinal rule of the book and of Oliver's approach, that one must listen and listen closely and then more closely to the patient. For, Auden wrote, if migraine patients have a strong and a legitimate complaint, it's that they are looked at and drugged and charged, but not listened to. And since Auden's review, I see that Oliver has contributed more than 30 pieces to our pages. His first essay appeared in 1984. It was called The Lost Mariner. It was about a former sailor called Jimmy, who was in his 50s. He lived at the home for the age where Oliver was then working. He's a man whose brain had been so damaged that he still thought he was 19 years old. And he was in his 50s. And he was still living in the world of 1945. And he could remember hardly anything since, forgetting from one day or one hour to the next what happened to him. Now, Oliver recounts how he was so puzzled by this case that he wrote to Moscow, to the great Russian neurologist A.R. Luria, about Jimmy, who seemed, he said, to be surrounded by a moat of forgetting. And Luria wrote back saying, and I quote, a man did not consist of memory alone. He has will, he has feelings, sensibilities, moral being, and you may find ways to touch him. And Oliver, soon after, observed Jimmy in the chapel of the home, and he was taking communion. And he suddenly saw that Jimmy was wholly absorbed by that moment. And building on that observation, he found that Jimmy could also be absorbed by music and by flowers and gardening. Or he went on to tend the garden of the home for the aged. And in his essay about this case, Oliver wrote, when there is a great organic damage and dissolution, there remains, and I'm quoting him, the undiminished possibility of reintegration by art, by communion, by touching the human spirit. And this can be preserved in what seems a hopeless state of neurological devastation. Now, before and after that essay, Oliver has inquired into an astonishing variety of mental experience. When there was a protest at a school for the deaf in Washington, he went down there to report for the New York Review. And then he wrote a long, definitive book on the nature of deafness and on sign language. As he's also written books on autism and Tourette's, and famously on people awakening from sleeping sickness. And on his own experience, when a bull smashed his leg to the point where it rendered it quite alien to him. And he has in his book Dr. Tungsten described growing up in a London family of physicians and scientists and his early outdoor adventures, biological adventures, with his longtime friend Jonathan Miller. And looking at these articles and his 10 books, I've only mentioned a few, I come back to his story of Jimmy and how he found that the empirical science of neurology, of which he is a technical master, took no adequate account, as he wrote, of what truly constitutes personal being. It is this perception of the human spirit that I believe runs as a continuing theme through his many works. And that is why, as Paul said, at Columbia, he's not only called a professor of psychiatry, but the university artist. And that's why he's very rightly known as our poet laureate of medical science, Oliver Sacks.
Thank you very much, Bob. Bob and I go back a long way, and we were originally introduced by Jonathan Miller in 1962, when Jonathan was here for Beyond the Fringe. When Bob saw my manuscript of The Lost Mariner, he said he wanted to see my original notes as well. And when he saw the original notes, he said that he thought a lot of them were much better than the so-called finished writing. And Bob is the most, not only the most sensitive, but the most hardworking and meticulous editor I've ever known. On one occasion, he phoned me when I was in New Zealand about a semicolon. I have called on him at odd times, at 3 a.m, on Christmas Day, on Yom Kippur. He is always there, practically hidden behind gigantic towers of books. There's no one like him. And I feel very honored at giving this Bob Silvers lecture. And also very delighted to be here at the library, because when I grew up in London, libraries were my home and my education. I was rather bad at school. I'm not good at being taught. I need to feel out information and knowledge and understanding in my own way, and libraries were crucial to me. And books allowed a communion with the dead and with everyone. And in particular, everything I've written, if it has stemmed partly from clinical experience or personal experience, has stemmed equally from books, and often old books. And so with my first book, Migraine, this was very much inspired by a book called Megrim, written in the 1860s. And since I'm talking about hallucinations today, one of the inspirations is this 1824 book, Sketches of the Philosophy of Apparitions. In 1824, the term hallucinations was not used in its present sense. One had apparitions, phantasms, specters, ghosts. The term hallucinations only took on its present slightly disquieting meaning in the late 1830s. If you don't trust gravity, what can you trust? This is one of the earliest English books to disburden itself of the supernaturalist feeling about ghosts and apparitions and spirits. Until the 1750s or so, anyone who hallucinated was seen as inspired by God or demon or a muse or whatever. And of course, there was a huge, and still is a huge, folklore of all sorts of extra natural beings, angels, aliens, ghosts, elves, Little Green Men now, which have probably to some extent, I'll come back to this, been inspired by dreams and hallucinations. Maybe one, before I go any further, one needs to say, what I mean, or roughly what is meant by a hallucination. You seem a fairly sober audience, but I'm sure a lot of you hallucinate. It's rather evident when someone hallucinates. They listen, they look. There's a sudden overwhelming feeling of a sound, a smell, a vision from outside. This is not at all like an image. Your imagination is your own. You recollect and you put things together, whereas a hallucination tends to appear suddenly, full-blown, involuntarily, and not apparently anything to do with you. And it's only when you can't find an outside source that you start to think in a bewildered way that something is going on out of control and automatically in you. If I can quote William James, he says that hallucinations are often mistaken for images. He says, but where a hallucination is complete, it is much more than a mental image. A hallucination is a strictly sensational form of consciousness, as good and true a sensation as if there were a real object there. The object happens to be not there. That's all. It's so much fun reading William James. One goes back again and again. You can never exhaust the principles. It's a marvelous, marvelous book. The term hallucination was introduced in the context of mental illness and delusion in the late 1830s. And unfortunately, for many people, it continues to have that connotation. And this is a reason why many people who have non-psychiatric hallucinations are afraid to mention them and keep them to themselves. In the 1840s, other sorts of hallucination were freely described. Of course, De Quincey and Coleridge and others had been talking about opium, dreams and hallucinations. Hashish became very popular, and Baudelaire and many others spoke about that. Also, there was great attention from the 1840s on to the strange images or near hallucinations which can occur when one closes one's eyes at night and lets the mind go quiet and passive, but is not asleep. And I'm sure this happens with many of you, various patterns or images may rise in the mind very quietly. You're not yet dreaming. You still have a reflective consciousness, and you can observe these. Although there were thoughts that hallucinations were produced somehow by the brain, and the brain of the individual, and therefore mirrored the particularities of their experience and so forth, this couldn't be confirmed until about 15 years ago when one got ways of imaging the brain as people were hallucinating. But I'm going to come back to this later, and I think now I need to sort of start to tell you some stories. Although I came to medicine through zoology, no non-human animal can tell you about its hallucinations, although I'm sure some of them have hallucinations as well as dreams. If you don't hallucinate yourself, I do hallucinate a little bit myself, you have to listen very carefully and non-judgmentally and quietly and tactfully to what people may say. When I saw Jim, the Lost Mariner, some years ago, he was a patient in an old age home run by nuns, the Little Sisters of the Poor, where I have worked for more than 40 years. There are many elderly people there who, though intellectually intact, are somewhat deaf and somewhat blind. I am now among them. It came to me some years ago that those who were visually impaired or hearing impaired were prone to hallucinations. I didn't realize how prone at first, because as I've said, people are often frightened to mention these. They may be afraid that they're going mad or others will see them as mad, and it's only when they get to know you well that they may bring this out. Well, about 2 years ago, I got a call from Little Sisters about one of their patients, Rosalie, a woman in her mid-90s, previously well-behaved, but they said she is now hallucinating. She sees things everywhere. She's gone crazy, and we've called the psychiatrist. But they said, but maybe she has Alzheimer's, maybe she has a stroke, so we're calling you, the neurologist, as well. So they omitted to tell me, or certainly to emphasize, that she was blind. I went in to see Rosalie, and she was a physically and intellectually robust old lady, very sane, and very puzzled, and rather frightened. And she said that she had been almost blind for some years, and then that a few days before she'd started seeing things. So I said, what sort of things? And she said, people in Eastern dress, in drapes, walking up and down stairs. A man who turns towards me and smiles, but he has huge teeth on one side of his mouth. Animals too. I see this scene. It's snowing, a soft snow, it's swirling. I see this horse with a harness dragging snow away. Then one night the scene changes again. I see cats and dogs walking towards me. They come to a certain point and then stop. Then it changes again. I see a lot of children. They're walking up and down stairs. They wear bright colors like Eastern dress. And she'd been seeing this for several nights. I asked her if the experience was like a dream, and she said, not in the least. She said, it's like a movie. She said, a silent movie, it's colored, it's three-dimensional, it's silent, and it's rather boring. She says, all these people walking up and down stairs, all this Eastern dress. And she said that these visions, they came and went, they seemed to have nothing to do with her. She'd never experienced anything like this. And she hadn't, in fact, mentioned them to the nurses, but obviously they'd seen her looking around. She thought the visions, she didn't recognize any of the people or the places or the animals in her visions. And the visions didn't seem to have anything to do with her, with what she was thinking or doing or even saying. And although she was curious and amused and fascinated and slightly frightened, the visions didn't seem to carry any particular emotional charge. She was not in the middle of them as one is in the middle of a dream. She was observing them in her room. But she was frightened. She'd never had anything like this. She'd never heard of anything like this. She wondered if she was losing her mind or having a stroke, whatever. So I went over her carefully. She was in good health. I couldn't find anything the matter. She wasn't on any medication which might produce hallucinations, but she was manifestly blind and had a retinal condition called macular degeneration. And I said, I think I know what's going on. I said, and this proneness of blind people to hallucinations was vividly described 250 years ago by a Swiss naturalist called Charles Bonnet. And I said, you have Charles Bonnet syndrome. And she was very, and there's nothing wrong with your brain or the rest of you, and that this is a fairly benign syndrome, and it'll probably disappear in a few days, and even if it doesn't, you will learn to live with it and maybe enjoy it. So she was very reassured and also tickled that there should be a proper name, a Swiss name, attached to her condition. And she said, who was this Charles Bonnet? Did he have it himself? And she said, tell the nurses that I have Charles Bonnet syndrome. I'm not one of your regular demons. I have Charles Bonnet syndrome. In fact, Charles Bonnet did not have it at the time he wrote about it, but his grandfather did, Charles Lulin. His grandfather was an eminent magistrate, approaching 90, who'd had cataracts and operations and was losing his vision, although not totally blind, like Rosalie. And Charles Bonnet induced his grandfather to dictate an account of the hallucinations. This amazing account, which fills 18 pages of a notebook, was lost for 150 years, but found at the beginning of the 20th century. And Charles Bonnet himself only made a brief summary of the enormously rich situation his grandfather was in. His grandfather recognized some of the hallucinations as such. So when he saw a blue handkerchief in midair, he knew it was a hallucination. You don't have blue handkerchiefs in midair. But when his granddaughters came to visit him, and he said, and who are these handsome young men with you? They looked downcast and said, alas, there were no handsome young men. And the handsome young men disappeared after a minute or so, as the handkerchief did. These Charles Bonnet visions are fugitive. They come and go. Sometimes they're of different sizes. On one occasion, Charles Lulin saw a carriage, a hallucinatory carriage approaching, which got larger and larger until it towered above the tops of the houses. There was a huge variety. And transformations were typical. So on one occasion, there was a swarm of specks that turned into a flight of pigeons, and then dancing butterflies. On one occasion, he saw an elderly man in a bathrobe smoking a pipe and realized that was himself. The hallucinations and the misperceptions can be very remarkable. One of my patients, a visually impaired but very bright woman, who has in fact just finished her latest book, has had all sorts of hallucinations. On one occasion, she said, I asked her to keep a journal of her hallucinations, and until she did this, she said she had no idea that there were so many, and so many each day. And certainly one tends to forget these. So on one occasion she said, I saw what looked like a teenage boy on the front hood of our car, leaning on his arms with his feet up in the air. He stayed there for about 5 minutes. Even when we turned, he stayed on the hood of the car. As we pulled into the restaurant parking lot, he ascended into the air, up against the building, and stayed there till I got out of the car. Occasionally, she would have complex replications. She described how, on one occasion, there was she was in a restaurant with her husband. A man was paying at the cash register, a man with a striped shirt, and he turned round and divided into six or seven men, all in striped shirts, and all with the same gestures, who walked towards her, and they collapsed, concertina-like, into a single person. So there can be very, very strange hallucinations and misperceptions with this Charles Bonnet. Though on another occasion, this lady was looking at the television and saw people were descending from a plane, but then their descent continued down the console of the television set onto the carpet as tiny Lilliputian people. Again, these hallucinations are purely visual, and even though dogs may appear to bark and people's mouths may move, there's no sound. Silent, silent movies. Charles Bonnet syndrome was regarded as quite rare, very rare indeed, until about 1990. And this surprised me, and in fact, one of the things I wanted to write about in my hat book in 86, but I didn't. I wrote about musical hallucinations then, and I wanted to write about this analogous form of visual hallucinations. I was going to. There was a little episode at that time when I had a fall, and I broke an arm and a leg. And as I was being taken into hospital, into the emergency room, the resident said, "What's that written on your hand?" And I said, "Oh, that's a patient with Charles Bonnet syndrome. I'm on my way to see her." And he said, "No, you're not. You're the patient now." And so I was, and so Charles Bonnet didn't get dealt with then. There can be all sorts of very strange juxtapositions and conflations. So, for example, Charles Lulin described that some people would have on a bizarrely elaborate headdress, bigger than they were. Some of them might have a box on their head. Sometimes they might have a bird on their head. One of my patients tends to see little mannequins coming out of the cheek. In general, the hallucinations are strange or bizarre, but not directly threatening. You have no interaction with Charles Bonnet hallucinations. And some people can feel fairly comfortable with it. One man who sent me a very delightful account said in his account, he describes his hallucinations being altogether friendly, and he imagines his eyes saying, "Sorry to have let you down. We recognize that blindness is no fun, so we've organized this small syndrome, a sort of coda to your sighted life. It's not much, but it's the best we can manage." I'm very touched by this. I think it's a very gallant thing to say. With Charles Lulin, in the months that he had this, would often go into a dark room in order to have a quiet showing of his hallucinations. And his grandson said, "His mind makes merry with the images. The brain is a theater where the stage machinery puts on performances, which are all the more amazing because they are unexpected." And so again here, this is a poetic, metaphorical, but also neurological notion of these. Charles Bonnet didn't imagine for a moment that, you know, the visions were coming from outside. He realized that something was going on in what he took to be the visual parts of the brain, and which he thought to be the parts normally involved in visual perception and visual imagination. But this notion had to wait nearly more than 200 years to be confirmed. There've always been descriptions of people having visions in situations of darkness and silence and isolation, whether they are holy men in caves or prisoners isolated. The term prisoner cinema got into the literature around 1920 for the sort of hallucinations which people could have in these circumstances. After World War II, there were a lot of unexpected accidents, especially with high-flying aviators facing a featureless blue sky for hours and hours, and sometimes truckers facing an endless white road. And this set off experiments on sensory deprivation. In the early experiments was really a total sensory deprivation. People were not only in dark rooms or blindfolded, the rooms were soundproof, there was no speech, they had cuffs on, but even with pure visual deprivation, just wearing a blindfold, everyone starts getting hallucinations within a few hours. Hallucinations, visual hallucinations, which can become almost continuous after 3 days. And this brings home the fact that in something like Charles Bonnet syndrome, you don't have to have an actual disease or pathology of the eye or the optic nerves or the visual parts of the brain. It's sufficient to be to have impairment of input. And what it brings up, as dreams bring up in another way, is that the brain is always active. The old notion used to be that when you're asleep, the brain shuts down. On the contrary, it is more active than dreaming than at any other time, but it's a different sort of activity. And this is also true of the perceptual systems. If there's no visual input, the visual system doesn't shut down. It becomes hungry, it wants activity, it has to keep going, and it will start to generate images or hallucinations of its own. And one can show that with visual deprivation or visual impairment, the visual parts of the brain become hyperactive. And in particular, those parts of the brain which would perceive particular things, there are different parts of the brain involved, say, in the perception of faces, of animals, of landscapes, of writing, and of this and that. And if one does imaging, as one can do, on someone while they are experiencing hallucinations, when they say, oh, I see a face, or whatever, or maybe like Rosalie, and you know, greatly enlarged teeth on one side, you will find activity, a sudden surge of activity in that particular part of the brain. There's also quite recently been a description of particular cells in the brain which are involved in the perception of or recognition of faces and landscapes, and these too become active. So I think what one has to envisage, normally one's visual lexicon, I mean, there must be visual lexicons at many, many levels. This is a fairly primitive one where the visual hasn't yet been correlated with memory, with emotion, with other senses. This is a purely visual parts of the brain. Normally, one has no consciousness of this because they are seamlessly integrated into your perception and your imagination. But with these hallucinations, suddenly you have a release of these parts of the brain, and they become anarchic and explosive, and they're shooting off hallucinations in all directions. You will perhaps do your best to give some meaning or some narrative to the hallucinations, as perhaps you do in dreams. But whereas with dreams, you can only recollect, and only recollect a few fragments, with hallucinations like this, you can give a blow-by-blow account. And some of the best accounts, I'll read you a little bit, have been given by people who have a tape recorder and just murmur into it as the scenes go on. But here you really have an amazing revelation of what goes on in parts of the brain, you know, which are normally inaccessible. If I can find what I want. There is a poet whom Bob published some poems of in 96, Virginia Adair. Virginia Adair wrote many poems. She was born in 1913. She wrote many poems in her 20s and 30s, but then she opted for a life of scholarship, and her poetic voice became silent for 50 years, nearly 50 years. In her late 70s, she started to lose her vision and to have hallucinations. And this reignited, inspired and reignited her poetic voice. And in fact, her first book of poems, Ants on the Melon, was published when she was 83. I was sent an astounding journal, and I fear I cannot find it now. For many years, she kept an amazing journal, which I think was partly whispered and dictated, of her hallucinations. So this is the raw material. And hallucinations in someone this gifted and with this rich imagination can be very astounding. And then this led to various poems. Now, I want to talk a little bit about another sort of hallucination where you don't have to be blind or visually impaired. And I mentioned this before. These are the hallucinations one may get as one's dropping off to sleep. The so-called hypnagogic hallucinations. I want to read you a little bit from a letter I got from a correspondent in Australia. For me, correspondence is absolutely crucial. I can only see a few patients a week, a handful, a dozen, but I get hundreds of letters. I will also say that the best correspondents are in Australia. And the best readers. I get more interesting, intelligent letters from Australia, really, than the rest of the world. So here is one letter, and when I get these letters, I put them away, and if they're interesting. So in fact, this letter arrived in 1992, but it has just sort of come back into my mind. So this man describes how his visions occur at the moment when the head hits the pillow at night, the eyes close. And instead of the turbulent darkness, I see imagery. The image is some, and he said, whatever is first glimpsed is transformed in the most extraordinary ways at great speed. Shapes are seen, replicated, multiplied, reversed in negative, shown in three dimensions, squeezed into lines, curved into new shapes. Color is added, tinted, subtracted. Textures are the most fascinating. Grass becomes fur, becomes hair follicles, becomes waving, dancing lines of light, and 100 other variations that my words are too coarse to describe. Incidentally, when Galton, Darwin's cousin, wrote about these hallucinations in his 1882 book, he said that if he had been asked, do you see anything when you close your eyes at night, he would have said no, but that he then started thinking about this, and the more he observed, the more he had, although he said what he got was too elaborate and too fugitive to be described, too elaborate and too fugitive. This correspondent of mine, he continues, he says there's absolutely no emotional overtones. The transformations occur without any apparent direction, but there is an associative logic to them. The whole experience seems to be devoid of meaning. I'm reminded on the one hand of the lines from Goethe's Faust, formation, transformation, eternal minds, eternal recreation, but on the other hand, the whole experience is characterized by purposelessness. It is as if the mind had been put into idle mode and one had accidentally lifted the cover off the image-producing engine of the brain and there was a great flywheel still spinning without the gears engaged. I loved this letter, and when I wrote back to him in 92, I said, I hope on some occasion I can quote your letter. And then about a month ago, I wrote to him again, saying the time has now come. And this often happens with me. And so I got an amazed and charming letter back in which he said, you know, quote all you can. I'm going to. I should have said this at the start. I'm not going to speak about the hallucinations of schizophrenia, about psychiatric hallucinations, even though the term hallucination was given this particular meaning in the 1830s. The hallucinations of psychosis or schizophrenia tend to be verbal, or considerably verbal. They are addressed to one. They accuse, they seduce, they cajole, they whatever. And they embody feelings and passions and thoughts and beliefs and delusions sometimes. None of this is the case with the sort of hallucinations I'm talking about, which blind people may get, or all of us may get, as we're falling asleep. I also won't say much about dreams, because it's so gigantic a subject, although I think I will say that there is a division between what one might call the Freudian view of dreams as embodied ideas and feelings and often disguised and conflicted, and Alan Hobson's idea that dreams are basically a sort of hallucinatory explosion which occurs in one's sleep and which one tries to give meaning to. For Freud, meaning as primary. For Hobson, meaning as added. I partly go along, I think, with both of those. I'm a compromiser. I'm always in the middle. Or I like to think it's, or to use a phrase of Leibniz, in the center of perspectives. That sounds better than compromise, which sounds cowardly. Well, dreams. There can also be hallucinations of a rather different sort as one wakes from sleep. And these may be have a rather different quality and be a little scary. And so here is a letter from another Australian correspondent. They're all there. He said, I'm plagued, by the most terrifying malady, horrible hallucinations, brilliantly clear and very real. I wake from a calm sleep and perhaps a fairly normal dream with a shock, and there before me is a creature that even Hollywood couldn't create. The hallucinations fade in about 10 seconds, and I can move when I have them. In fact, I usually jump about a foot in the air and scream. He mentions this because there's a condition called narcolepsy, in which one is prone to overwhelming sleep and to sudden dreams and to the hallucinations before and after dreams. That may also go with a sort of so-called sleep paralysis when you can't move. And he is saying that he doesn't have this. He said, the hallucinations are becoming worse now about 4 a night. I'm becoming afraid of going to bed. The following are some examples of what I see. A huge figure of an angel standing over me. A rotting corpse lying next to me. A huge crocodile at my throat. A dead baby on the floor covered in blood. Giant spiders, very frequent. I agree, they are very frequent. I haven't had that particular one myself, but at least half a dozen people have brought up spiders. I think they must be hardwired somewhere, you know, arachnophobia in the brain. Clouds of smoke. This is a very Australian thing. I'm not sure what it means. Inside a huge fuse box. Unlike the delicate hallucinations as one falls asleep, where you know these are just quiet apparitions, these hypnagogic ones can be frightening. If you wake up and there's a pterodactyl 2 foot above your face, your heart beats suddenly. Sometimes these hypnopompic hallucinations, as they're called, seem to be waking dreams, continuations of nightmares into the waking state, but not always. And they can occur at any age. They're probably younger in childhood. A friend of mine has had a patient, a 10-year-old boy, who woke up, a 10-year-old boy who was really a rather atheistic, secular boy who loved chemistry, rather like someone I know. But this boy woke at night and he saw a tall, radiant woman by his bed who resembled his departed grandmother and who intimated to him somehow, I don't think there was actual speech, that she was his guardian angel. And he turned on the light, and she was still there. And he ran out to his parents, and when he came back, she'd gone. Now, he's having a lot of difficulty integrating this experience. He doesn't believe in angels. He doesn't believe in the supernatural, although it's better to have a guardian angel than a pterodactyl. Now, one begins to see how belief in spirits and ghosts is likely to happen if this occurs in youth or in other communities. I think if I can find it. There are many literary accounts and literary analyses of hallucinations of all sorts. There's an immense literature on drug hallucinations there's a beautiful book called Opium and the Romantic Imagination, and then of course there's all the recent psychedelia. Some of the authors of that time were almost satisfied with hypnagogic imagery. So, for example, Edgar Allan Poe writes, there is a class of fancies of exquisite delicacy which arise in the soul only at its epochs of most intense tranquility and at those mere points in time where the confines of the waking world blend with those of the world of dreams. I am aware of these fancies only when I am on the brink of sleep, with the consciousness that I am so. And Poe, in fact, was very punctilious about this and would not let himself drift into sleep, but would wake himself up and transcribe these fancies and use many of them in his own works. So hypnagogic imagery was important for him, as Charles Bonnet hallucination was important for Virginia Adair. There are wonderful descriptions by De Quincey and Coleridge. Again, not so much of pure drug states, but of the heightening and prolongation of hypnagogic states with drugs. And for De Quincey and Coleridge and Wordsworth, who also had very startling hypnagogic imagery, and Southey, and for Baudelaire and others in France, this sort of thing was an analog of the creative process, but at a very primitive level, in that there would be a swarming of involuntary figments which would then come together and juxtapose themselves in various ways and sometimes form simple scenes or stories. For them, this was sometimes a direct antecedent and certainly an analog of the creative process. I think I need to wind up a little bit. As a neurologist, I encounter people. People come to me with stories of hallucination, or I elicit stories. Hallucination can occur in many other conditions, and Parkinson's disease, and Alzheimer's, and with various medications. If people are on steroids, my function as a neurologist is first to clarify and reassure. Very, very crucial. There are hundreds of thousands of people who are having visual hallucinations, who are terrified of it, and really they need to be reassured. As a scientist or a physiologist, I'm fascinated at this window into the brain, into a primitive image-forming part of the brain, and, as it were, seeing the brain at play, a primitive part of the brain at play. Beyond that, I can't help wondering how much this gets into common discourse as folklore and as belief in spirits and apparitions and so forth. Very particularly common in hallucinations are Lilliputian hallucinations, little people. And in every culture you have elves, fairies, gnomes, leprechauns, sprites. I think the little people of the world may come from hallucinations. I think this is also so of angels and aliens, but I would hesitate to tell that to the 80% of the population who believe in them. I think at this point I've probably stretched your patience enough, and so I will. I'd be happy to go on for hours, but for the moment, I think I've said enough, and I thank you very much.
Don't be shy. Hi.
Hello.
A lot of your research is on
I may need you to mediate. I'm sort of deaf, and often amplification isn't enough.
A lot of your research is personally based. A lot of your books are case-by-case basis. And a lot of the research today seems to be technology-based, and, you know, there's a lot of neuroimaging research. And considering the prominence of technology like fMRI and the statistical questions about statistical rigorousness, how has this affected the way you conduct your research, and do you have any sort of skepticism towards the way the field works?
I miss 90%. I'm sorry. Oh, yeah. Well, I think there's... I share it to some extent. And I think there is a sort of a new reductionism in the air, which will say, whatever, hallucinations are just activity here, morality is just activity there, God is just activity there. It's tremendously important to have these neural correlates. And I will say I've jumped into a functional imager several times myself in relation to music and also in relation to vision. Buber said many years ago, we must humanize technology before it dehumanizes us. I mean, I think there is a risk of diminished attention and feeling for the person, and you just may want to get them into the MRI as soon as possible. I do think that sort of doctor-patient relationships, but beyond that, the appreciation of the sheer complexity of mental states can feel slightly threatened by crude technology. But hopefully we will find a balance.
I was just hoping that this would be the subject of your next book.
It is. it's one of the subjects. The next book is going to be about vision and visions, and it will deal with many other things as well, and visual imagination and stereo vision, and the sort of strobe vision which I wrote about in the New York Review of Books, and even a little bit on my own vision, which has changed a lot since I lost an eye, started having some quiet hallucinations of my own.
It's fabulous to hear you speak. Thank you so much. My question is regarding seizures and hallucinations. I'm wondering if you think there's any sort of relationship between some types of seizures and epilepsy and hallucinations.
Yes, right. One of my chapters is about epileptic visions, and there are some sorts of seizure which include visual components and sometimes consist exclusively. Some of these are very simple seizures where someone will see a little glittering ball, say somewhere up to the right for a few seconds, but there may also, especially if the temporal lobes of the brain be involved, there may be much more complex hallucinations which are of dreamlike intensity and involvement, and also have strong elements of memory and fantasy, which the Charles Bonnet ones don't have. Some of the temporal lobe ones may also go with a strong mystical feeling. We have great detail about Joan of Arc and her visions. And she was a particularly calm and eloquent thoughtful describer. And it seems probable that she had temporal lobe epilepsy and epileptic visions, and was initially rather skeptical of any sort of meaning or theological significance. But in some of these epileptic visions, if people come to surgery, one may find particular parts of the brain which are involved. There's a moderately recent book, by Mark Salzman. The title is either Insomnia or Lying Awake. Which is it? Well, it was something like that. But it describes a nun who has visions of God, and is then found to have a brain tumor. And the question arises as to whether removal of the tumor will remove her visions. I leave you to read the book.
Thank you so much.
Hello, Professor Sachs. First off, it is absolutely wonderful to hear you speak in person. I have read a great many of your books. I have a great many questions for you, actually, but it seems we have a bit of a queue going, so I'm going to have to limit myself. My first question is, has it really never happened that a visual hallucination or an auditory hallucination was also accompanied by a hallucination in the other sense, in the other modality?
Before you get on to the others, what's it?
Has it ever happened that there was a sort of auditory element to a visual hallucination, or yes, vice versa?
When one is, say, falling asleep, the Charles Bonnet are exclusively visual. Mm-hmm. But as one is falling asleep, there can be auditory hallucinations as well. Mm-hmm. Although, interestingly, the auditory and the visual are usually not correlated. Mm. So you may see people, their mouths moving, but no voices, and voices and no faces. Mm. So it's almost as if there is a separate stimulation of the visual, the auditory, the tactile, the olfactory, whatever. But at a higher level, mm-hmm. especially the level of temporal lobe epilepsy, which the last person brought up, then all of these are brought together, and you may have full scenes in which it's a Monday evening in Manhattan, somewhere near the public library, and it's late in September, and an entire scene with all its and the smells of chestnuts in the street, and in which every sensory mode and every emotion can be brought together. You have this typically in the higher order hallucinations.
I see.
And of course you can have this in some of the drug hallucinations. With drug hallucinations, if one has them, typically occur at every level. At the simplest level, there may just be sort of patterns, hexagons, tessellations, mandala figures, whatever you like to call them, and going up to higher and higher levels. All being in a way simultaneously and sometimes independently going on. Now, you had some other questions.
The other question is simply a sort of more academic question. I'm currently studying psychology and neuroscience, and I was just wondering if you happen to have any readings in music perception that you might be able to recommend. It's a little self-serving.
Sorry, I can't hear two people. So just start again. Reading and music perception.
Yes.
I am going to leave music alone tonight. Why don't you read the book by my colleague Dan Leviton? This is your brain on music. I saw a manuscript of Dan's book at the same time as he saw one of my book, and we agreed that we were complementary. So if you've read Musicophilia, read its complement.
Great. Thank you so much.
Pleasure.
Good evening. Can a high fever cause hallucinations?
Yes, yeah, indeed. A high fever can cause all sorts of things. It can cause seizures, but certainly hallucinations. And one of my correspondents mentioned to me that whenever he had a fever, he saw musical notation. Musical notation, by the way, or seeing writing, is a rare form of visual hallucination anyhow, but he invariably had this when he had a fever. And indeed, if he started to hallucinate music, he knew a fever was coming on. And I think that's generally the case.
I'd like to join those before me in expressing my admiration and ask you, can and or do those born blind hallucinate?
They can't hallucinate visually. There's no visual experience, no visual memory, no visual images, and in a way, no idea of vision. This is discussed partly in a fascinating exchange of letters between two philosophers, one sighted and one congenitally blind. It's just called On Blindness. Having said that, one does wonder what is happening to the visual parts of the brain in those born yes. blind, whether they've been, there's much to show that they are reallocated to other functions. For example, the reading finger, the braille reading finger of someone congenitally blind has an enormous representation in the visual cortex. But one wonders if there might be some way of stimulating visual parts of the brain other than through the eyes. Something which comes to my mind here, say, is with regard to the phenomenon of synesthesia, when different senses may be coupled, and for example, people may see colors when they hear music or when they read letters. And there have been descriptions of people who are partly colorblind who say that when they are synesthetically stimulated, they will see colors they have never seen with their eyes. One such person spoke of Martian colors. There have also been some descriptions of congenitally blind people taking LSD or things like this and saying they see. I think the answer isn't quite clear, but by and large, I would say they can have hallucinations of any other sort. Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
It's similar with congenitally and deaf people. If, for example, they become schizophrenic, they may say they hear voices, but probably messages are. This is probably only a manner of speaking.
Right.
Sometimes the messages are assigned to them explicitly, and somehow it's just intubated without being auditory.
Yes. Thank you.
Right.
After your 120 more years of life, and when your brain is dissected and everything is discovered that made you such a splendid thinker and conveyor of your thoughts. Has anything, it occurred to me, that people may now want to know what's up there? An MRA, for instance, or any other kind of examination of your brain.
I caught bits of that. Yes. In some sense, I am in my brain, as everyone is in their brains, but I think that's not entirely
but one also wants to say that one only exists in one's actions and when one does things. Now, people have, when Gauss died, the great mathematician, people looked at his brain very, very closely. It was actually a rather small brain, but the convolutions were said to be exceptionally tight. Of course, then, you know, in the 1850s, there'd really been there was no notion of nerve cells and no microscopy. When Einstein died, his brain was filched by the pathologist, and little bits were farmed out here and there. In fact, there's a very strange book called Driving with Albert, which is about a cross-country journey with part of Einstein's brain in the trunk of the car. It's been thought that that there may be an extra parietal lobule or something in Einstein's brain which went with his power of spatial thinking. Be that as it may, I mean, one can imagine that many other people have such a lobule and are not, you know, would not be Einstein. I don't think a brain alone is sufficient. You need a nurture and a culture and circumstances and everything else. Microscopy and just looking at the anatomy of a brain isn't going to be enough. There are 100 billion neurons, and each neuron is connected to 1,000 or 10,000 others. There are inconceivably complex networks in the brain which are continually going on. The world's computational capacity is probably not much greater than what goes on in a single brain. And if one could, that is the correlate of a person, not the post-mortem tissue. And how much of that one could ever catch, I don't know. We are catching things at a crude level now, so you can tell, for example, that people are indulging in musical imagery or visual imagery, but you can't go much further than that. By the same token, although Freeman Dyson and others have talked about electronic telepathy, it seems probable that the coding of experience and reality is individual in everybody's brain, so that even if you could have a complete brain print from me, you wouldn't know how to interpret it.
Thank you.
We'll take one more question.
Thank you very much for your talk. My question is, do you think that all the religious visions that have been described are hallucinations? Or do you make distinctions in those descriptions? And if you do think that they are hallucinations, have you discussed it with, I don't know, some church authorities?
I have to excuse myself tonight. I've really not dealt with visions, either at the psychiatric level or, if you want, the spiritual level, and I don't equate those, although they sometimes go together, so that when, say, George Fox, who was both a religious genius and a bit nutty, approached Lichfield and said, "Woe to the bloody city," and saw the streets of Lichfield running with blood. Blake obviously had a lot of visions. In some cultures, it's much more allowable to have visions, or if you want to call it hallucinations. And although I've been speaking about a sort of a fairly primitive physiological, you know, bottom-up sort of hallucination, obviously when thoughts and feelings become more and more intense, they can engender something like hallucinations, which may be religious, which may be scientific. I mean, if one reads Faraday's journals, I think he hallucinated lines of force and magnetic fields. You know, it was getting that vivid. I don't know how to put this. In a way, I'm. And this also comes back, perhaps, to the business of reductionism. In my first book, I wrote about Hildegard of Bingen. Hildegard, this 12th century nun and mystic, had visual migraine. And some of the zigzags and other geometric figures which she saw in her migraines, she interpreted as the ramparts of the city of heaven. She gave a spiritual interpretation to her migraine visions. This doesn't mean, this is no reason to dismiss her, to say, well, you know, this was just migraine. For her, it was not just migraine. The migraine inspired, if you want, a vision of the heavenly city. I think that all spiritual matters, if you want, you know, have to be dealt with on their own grounds and not on the physical basis. It really doesn't matter whether, a vision may be epileptic, may be drug abuse, it may be associated with blindness. If it carries any value, its value will be intrinsic to it and nothing to do with the physical basis. And I think I will leave it there.
Now, before giving you Oliver Sacks, who will be signing some books at 192 Books is presenting today, I would like to ask you very quickly one question. The relationship between insomnia and hallucination. Because the lack of sleep, which you believe is such a productive space, if you suffer from insomnia, yeah, what does it do to your hallucinations?
There are at least two sorts of sleep. There's the sleep which is so-called REM sleep, which is associated with highly visual dreaming, and other sleep. If you are deprived of sleep, and if in fact you are just deprived of REM sleep alone, which can be done if one is hooked up to a machine, and you wake the person every time they start dreaming, then the impulse to dream, the need to dream, will become greater and greater, and it will finally burst into the conscious state as hallucination. And although there are easier ways, if you want to hallucinate, stay up for a week, but it's easier to smoke some pot or something.
Thank you very much.
Okay.